The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to Music Weekly. I'm Alexis Petridis. Coming up on the show, we'll be talking to Adam Harper about the infinite possibilities of music and why we should all stop being so retro. There's a very sweary singles club, plus a track from last week's Band of the Day live session. All here on Music Weekly from The Guardian. Delighted to be joined this week by Dan Hancox. Hello.
Hello, Alexis.
And Ben Beaumont-Thomas.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Excellent.
Yeah. You've always been doing something exciting, unlike me. What have you been doing?
I went to see Prokofiev's First and Fifth Symphony last night.
Amazing.
Which I can only describe as banging.
Was it banging?
It was banging. It was emphatic, bombastic.
Wow.
I'm in danger of going down a rhyming route here, so I'll leave it at that. But yeah, no, inspiring stuff, actually.
I went to the pub with one of Fields of the Nephilim today.
What did they have to say for themselves?
Not so much. Ben.
Yes, I've been having a good week. I saw a fantastic lineup of a night called A Night at the Haunted Dance Hall last week, which was in near Liverpool Street, and featuring my number one UK live act at the moment, which is Raime, R-A-I-M-E, who were very sort of crushing, slow, murky techno dub kind of music.
Right.
Very, very impressive. And this sort of slowed down images of Tarkovsky in the background.
Wow.
Incredibly atmospheric stuff, yeah.
Is that what Haunted Dance Hall is then?
I guess so, yeah, yeah.
Exciting.
As I said, I went to the pub with the lead singer of Fields and the Nephilim today. Ben, it is a good thing that you are here, because you can explain what we're going to hear next. Slightly complicated.
Yes.
Nothing less than an interview with a man who claims to have a new system for imagining music based on the infinite possibilities of 21st century technology. Ben, tell us about it.
Indeed, yes, that man is Adam Harper, who's written this book called Infinite Music, and I think it's a very inspirational book and also very necessary at the moment for this time when people have been accused of very much living in the past and looking backwards and sort of this retromania idea. And Adam's book is in many ways a reminder of the sheer breadth of potential in music making, both born off the back of new technology, but also I think recalibrating what we think even music to be and reimagining it in spaces, sort of live spaces and on the dance floor, and as a kind of social setting. So it's a very complex book, but really, really worth delving deeply into.
Fantastic. What did you talk about when you met him?
Well, I began by asking him how exactly artists can sort of tap into this potential infinity of music with their creative impulses.
It's one of the key debates that we're having in music criticism at the moment is where's the imagination gone? Why are we sort of going back and copying the past? In many ways, yeah, I think it is infinite music is a bit of a response to that kind of sentiment, certainly. The way in which you tap into the infinity there is not just kind of egging people on and saying that there are infinite possibilities, but actually pinpointing exactly what the smallest and the broadest forms of musical invention, musical difference and musical change are. So what I suggest is that there are infinite number of variables and they interlock and relate and create musical objects. And one of the things I do along the way is explain exactly what musical objects are. They're not just sounds.
So what sort of non-sonic variables can there be? Because obviously most people think of music as a purely sonic sort of force in many ways.
That's definitely the kind of 20th century Western assumption about music making. But even the most kind of a modernist and high art of music critics or performers would accept that there is a social dimension to music making, a visual dimension to music making, and especially when you get to pop music, when people are wearing certain costumes. I mean, Kiss and Devo are the typical examples of bands that are using a non-sonic element as part of the whole experience.
Like Lady Gaga, for example, whose music is quite generic, but then the costumes and sort of elaborate image she creates herself is very much part of that music making. The
music is just one dimension, as it were, one variable in a whole artistic package that can't be divided into your different senses. After the Second World War especially, there was a huge surge in ideology about new music, new forms of listening, new forms of composing, and it was a real atmosphere for invention and discovering a new continent, as it were, for music. And I think that subsided a little bit. People are more postmodern, people are more, as Reynolds points out, looking into the past and that kind of thing. But I think what we must follow is the spirit of modernism and not exactly what it did. And it's not exactly what the modernist composers like Schoenberg and Cage and Stockhausen did, but their departure from the norms of their time, that differential from their context, that is where their modernism lies and not in the specifics of their techniques.
Because you locate certain new school sort of dance artists as being musical modernists in this tradition, almost, people like Zombie, Actress, Burial. I mean, what are they doing that is radically new?
They're not doing anything that necessarily competes with Stockhausen and Cage in terms of being, I suppose, out there and entirely unfamiliar. But relative to their context, relative to the system in which they write music, they are an avant-garde. And I think that's an exciting way of looking at avant-garde music today, as not as kind of pushing out right to the outer reaches of sound. I think we've kind of more or less done that 50 years ago. It's about close and specific and complex information-rich exploration of musical possibilities in a social context. That is the most valuable form of avant-garde, and it's the one that actually gets people listening and enjoying and imagining new forms of music.
And so if the musical modernists of the 20th century, their experiments kind of broke down the door, effectively, now we're sort of exploring that space and the potential for that experimentation.
Absolutely, that's exactly how I would describe it. I mean, people like Zombie can be particularly at times striking in what they do, and yet they're on the dance floor and people listen to them, which I think is a slightly more successful way of practicing musical modernism than a load of professors and master students in a concert hall and that kind of thing as well.
And how much of this is to do with technology evolving? I mean, are we seeing ways of making music and modes of and sounds even that simply weren't possible before? And are new instruments being built that allowing more a greater infinity of music, if that isn't an absurd thing to say?
I mean, there are some sounds that have turned up that really have been unprecedented. You know, in the past 30 or 40 years, one of the methods I talk about towards the end of Infinite Music is granular synthesis, which was used in academic electronic composition in the 70s and the 80s, and found its way into the music of Ortega, particularly in the 90s and the noughties.
And so granular synthesis is what exactly?
Granular synthesis is when a sound is divided up into, it's basically exploded into all the grains that it's made up of, split second particles, if you like, grains of sound, which Curtis Rhodes calls microsound. And he's one of the people I identify as one of the, in a way, successors to Stockhausen in finding really unusual new sound worlds that we couldn't imagine before. It's actually really unusual if you think about it, the way we listen to music in the West. One group of people is sat at one side of the room and they can't speak. The other group is sat on the opposite side of the room, and they're dressed like servants, perhaps, or like kabuki stagehands. They're all dressed in black. You're not supposed to see them. They're not really supposed to be there. They're not really people. They're just channeling this transcendental sound that's coming out.
But then at the other end of the spectrum, you highlight some examples in your book, such as throat singing and tribal musics from Central Africa and so on, which are incredibly social.
Yeah, well, it's all about breaking. I mean, one of the most important political barriers in music is this kind of active, passive listener, performer dichotomy. Interactive music, it was never a huge modernist tradition. It really needs to be a part of the way we interact. Because if you're going along with all the ethnomusicologists and you believe that music is this enormously important social object, this kind of social glue, then it's particularly unhealthy that we kind of shut up and listen to it. We had to get involved in places all over the world, and particularly Africa. Music is something that everybody gets involved in. Sure, there are people who are better than others, people who kind of lead a little bit more than others, but it's something that everybody feels a part of. It just gives the lie to the fact that some people are born tone deaf or with no kind of musical ability, that everybody born into these tribes comes up with these extraordinary, very complex, subtle, improvisatory, musical statements.
Or in the case of the Inuits, it's kind of a sport.
Absolutely, yeah. So on the other side of the world, northern Canada and Alaska, there's this kind of music that, again, it isn't called music at all. It's really not thought of as a concert thing. And this is Inuit breathing games or throat singing. Two women will be opposite each other, and there will be a two-part phrase that they alternate and sort of phase between them. And it's a game to see how long you can last without laughing or losing your breath or missing your phrase and that kind of thing. So it's a kind of competitive element. And music as a game that you play, it's reasonably unimaginable. I mean, in the West today, people have rap battles, people have competitive dancing, but that's quite a specific social environment. It's not something that people do as part of their everyday lives.
Isn't there a danger, ultimately, that we do live in a certain culture and we will end up going down those prescribed stylistic routes? And you know, dubstep's a good example where you have a wonderful explosion of creativity from Croydon, and then that kind of gets reduced to a lot of people making a wub 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 sound rather than constantly becoming infinite, as you would kind of hope. I mean, there is a danger there, isn't there?
There needs to be a certain degree of cohesion. You can't just have infinite chaos over and over again. There has to be this equilibrium between infinity and the sameness and sort of one, if you like.
So it's a case of just constantly being aware of the possibilities and allowing that to influence your own music making.
Or being aware that you're inside a certain idea about music or a certain idea about the genre you're working with, and being aware that the boundaries of that object, that system, are flexible and should be stretched.
It's Ben Beaumont-Thomas there talking to Adam Harper. That reminded me very much of the conversation I was having with the lead singer of Fields of Nephilim earlier today. So let's sort of get to, you know, delve to the most basic thing that he's talking about here. This is a sort of reaction against the notion that all music, you know, all ideas have already been had in music and there is no identifiably futuristic and forward-looking music currently.
Yes,
made,
I think,
right?
So. And I think it's Adam's background is quite an academic one.
You never.
And I think he is coming from a world that I think can be very conservative. And I think it's but also, as we've seen with Simon Reynolds and Retromania, there's a conservatism in the pop world as well. So, as I said, I think it's a very necessary book that really reminds us of the basic building blocks of sound and how that they in turn can be broken up into all these sort of infinite parts effectively. And also, again, this idea of modern technology such as apps and for iPhone or something, allowing expression from ordinary people and that expression to be shared on SoundCloud or via other applications. So and broadening both the sheer kinds of noises that we can make, but also the network effect of that music and kind of creating an infinite matrix for it to spread across.
What he doesn't seem to be talking about is any kind of major sort of disjunctive leap in music like you might have expected at some point in the past, like, for example, in 1966 or in 1988 or whatever, where you appear to have these kind of sonic leaps that...
Yeah, I think that it's perhaps more of a cultural thing. Like he identifies Burial and Actress and the new school of, I guess, in inverted commas, post-dubstep kind of artists, the word he uses is dequantization, which is shifting beats completely off their kind of 4-4 strict axis. And it's done in a very subtle way that grabs you much less by the collar than, say, the Sex Pistols were doing.
But or an Acid House record would have
yeah,
been.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But it is as major, I think, a shift, perhaps.
And the key thing here is technological development. So, yes. I mean, a lot of the great disjunctions and leaps forward in sort of pop music history have come from some new innovation.
Absolutely.
From Cage onwards, like yeah, he's been mentioned.
I'd say so. And the point is now, I suppose, with infinite music is not only the infinite possibilities, which I think Adam's absolutely right to be optimistic about, but the infinite inputs into, you know, a musician's brain. You know, you can, the fact that you can access music from pretty much, you know, the entirety of human history.
And the entirety of the globe as well.
Yeah, quite.
Yes, exactly.
Which is critical.
I think an important point that Adam makes is the importance of instrument building, which is, you know, the likes of Ableton or Logic are these software programs that allow you to make electronic music are quite bewildering and still are quite bewildering these days. He's hoping, as do I, that these software programs will become more intuitive and allow people to create an infinity of music in a very simple
way. They're bloody complicated, aren't they?
Yeah.
If you talk to Ableton, as someone who, you know, is determinedly unskilled as a musician, that's vital to being a music critic. Looking at an open copy of Ableton is utterly baffling to me.
Yeah.
And yet, I suppose the point is that they are more widely available, those kind of types of software, than ever before. Mm. And you're looking at a kind of potential sort of revolution in terms of the egalitarian nature by which, you know, well, as long as you have a PC and a working copy of the internet, you can probably get hold of the materials to make this kind of music.
Just playing devil's advocate, you used the word potential revolution here, and it strikes me that in all this sort of discourse, it's all about something that may happen in the future. I mean, we're saying, you know, there's this infinite amount of music and you can access it from all over the world and all over history on the internet. It's available to anybody, you know, it's free, it's all this kind of thing. Yet, basically, everything in the charts sounds like a sort of trance record from 1997.
Yeah,
so,
I think
so
this
how
is,
does that
this is
work?
You're right to play devil's advocate here. I think this is the flip side of it. When you are given infinite possibilities, do you go to the path of least resistance and create something very simple? And will software that is more intuitive pare down the infinity and reduce the complexity? And that is a valid
on a very basic level, if there is this, you know, staring into an infinity of music, staring into infinity of anything is a scary thing to do. Is that one of the reasons why people keep making music that sounds like something people already know and feel comforted by and recognize, rather than, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but I think hasn't that always been the case, that there's been a vanguard always, but then the popular music has often been comforting and nostalgic.
The vanguard's going to exist outside of the charts ultimately.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing is that it requires so many like fewer sales to get to number one now, of course, than it did 10, let alone 20 years ago. But why that's led to this cluster of kind of very sort of samey and certainly not progressive kind of
but I think, you know, in terms of cultural revolution, I think that those giant ructions just aren't going to happen anymore with a kind of dispersed culture on the internet and across the world. And I think that there's always going to be room and more visibility for experimental and boundary pushing music than there ever has been.
And also, there's a sense, I was reading, Dan, you wrote a piece in the paper recently about Afrobeats, quite a good example of an array of music being available to people, because it's not like there's been an immense African influence in dance music, you know, certainly of that kind of music previously, and now this is happening, and this is the kind of big sort of thrust of really what's
going on. And it's immediately accessible on YouTube, and therefore, you know, a generation of 14 and 15 year olds can get at it immediately. People like Sarkodie and sort of similar kind of like superstars from Ghana and Nigeria have been big for about 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
But it's you know, it really bears remembering that YouTube didn't exist until 2006, and just how
was that on YouTube?
Yeah.
That's amazing. And that's how it's always been there.
Exactly.
And
that's how
the
recent
case of technology getting to the point in Ghana at the sort of source of the music that's allowing the rest of us who maybe had a longer period of maturation with YouTube and so on to suddenly access it now.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's reached a kind of an incredible rate of growth, something like YouTube. And then, you know, you've got things like Spotify as well, of course. And I think that's why, when, Alexis, you ask about the potential kind of for change here, well, I think part of the reason all of this discourse is so speculative at the moment is because we just have no idea. Things are moving so quickly that the development in 5 years is fairly, you know,
you can't really imagine
pretty unpredictable.
It.
Yeah,
yeah,
quite.
Yeah, that's really interesting. On a really basic level, have the pair of you heard anything in the last 6 months that completely validated this, that made you think, I have not? I mean, I appreciate we're saying those kind of huge disjunctions, that sort of moment when the first time you heard Acid Tracks by Fusion, what the hell is this kind of thing? That probably isn't going to happen anymore. What would you two offer as examples of music that could not have existed before 2012 or 2011?
I always say actress whenever anyone else will ask me this. I think his... It is a hybrid sound, but of kind of 80s boogie and sort of acid techno and so on. But then the way it's been reformed and textured, I think, is something I've never heard before.
I think I'd actually point you towards my choice for the singles club today.
Beautifully
at the end. Nice segue.
Fantastic. Well, let's use that as a segue and let's move into singles club. Let's just say that Adam Harper's book, Infinite Music, is published by Zero Books. You'll find a link to it at guardian.co.uk/music, where of course you can also rant and rave about the show. Let's move on to Singles Club. Let's start with that track that Dan mentioned. Take a hate on me if you want, but I'ma keep doing my thing until things get done. Yeah, man, you know me done. I'm on a tidal wave, you're on a microwave. I watch how quickly you get hotted up. Walk off and shoot, who gassed him up? Somebody must have led him on the wrong road. Please advise me, that's a hard drive. One of them, why they're best like you? None of them are better than a B-I-G-D-A-R-G-S rap. I know we bad boys, I will light up your dance, but don't have to do it every time they roll. More time to kick back, have a little chit chat in a car now with the yeah, like no. So anytime I look a man thinks that it's cold, squeeze and put the freeze on likes. Now I don't know why I look a man. That's Wiley, Flo Dan, Rico Dan, and Manga with the F off. Dan, you brought that in. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's a track that Wiley's leaked ahead of a forthcoming album. I mean,
I was going to say that now is his ambit. Yeah.
His new one is out, I think, around now on Big Dad, and that's very good. Does not contain this track. This is ahead of the next project. He's always on the next project, which is going to be a sort of dual project, I think, with Manga, who is the sort of slightly more high-pitched MC in there at the end. Those four are all like Roll Deep members. But it's fascinating to me, that particular track, because of the rhythm more than anything, which is, as I think Wiley spits, he says, spit on the rhythm and cut out the melody. There's no melody.
For the benefit of people who haven't heard the whole track, that's it, right? I mean, it's just that rhythm
exactly.
track.
And chorus. Rhyming. No chorus, no bridge, just sort of...
Wow.
Just congos, bongos, that kind of thing. And I suppose the reason that I say that's an example of a track that could not have been made before is that it, you know, to me demonstrates the influence of African dance music from across the continent, which is obviously varied in so many different ways in terms of sort of tempo and sort of instrumentation. You know, there's a little bit of the kind of Kuduro spirit in there, as opposed to, I mean, the Afrobeats piece I wrote about was, I mean, that's more sort of Nigerian Ghana, it's a bit more hip-hoppy.
Kuduro is from where?
Kuduro is from Angola via Portugal a bit.
Okay.
I mean, similarly, kind of Kwaito from South Africa. These are all sort of slightly different styles, but it's, as one of the MCs, I think Rico acknowledges, an African style rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it was made by Wiley, who, you know, I don't think would have been listening to that kind of music otherwise, or indeed would have been 5 years ago, but it's obviously influencing his production style now, which has always been quite innovative and always looked to leap, sort of leap forward. I mean, as much as he's sort of known as an MC and sort of nutcase, he's also a master of the arts of
yeah, that's the thing that struck me about it was that on the one hand, lyrically, it's kind of all of the Wiley stock kind of cliches. You know, he's obsessed with his own legacy, he's obsessed with money, the kids who are coming up beneath him, all these things articulated in a really always interesting way. But more of the same, whereas the rhythm compared with, you know, something like Igloo or Ice Rink or these early sort of grime instrumentals he's really famous for, so much more relentless and constant and flowing rather than just falling over the place with snares everywhere, which I thought, you know, really marked a real sea change, I think, in his production. Yeah.
It's a really exciting track. I think you know, you can sort of dissect it in an intellectual way and go, well, this bit's... But, I mean, what I like about it is, on a really basic... It's a really exciting piece of music, and it makes you want to sort of get up and dance, and it proceeds at a kind of fairly steady, you know what I mean, whatever, 130 BPM kind of danceable rate. And there's something about stripping back the production that much that actually really allows the voices to shine, I think.
And technically very good. I mean, it's a cold thing to say, but technically amazing vocal.
Yeah, incredibly propulsive. Sort of. That's brilliant. So where do we find this?
It's available for free download, I think, if you Google it.
Amazing. Have you heard any other stuff from this forthcoming album? Is it all like that?
I don't know. I hope it is. I had to get in touch with someone who knows Wiley better than I do to find out who'd made the beat, and it turned out it was Wiley himself.
Right.
To which I said, "Well, that's fantastic. He's still kind of developing sort of new styles." But I think the point is to never be surprised by what comes out of Wiley's brain.
Fantastic. Right. Well, we shall move on to Ben's offering. Right, so who'd have thought? The new single by Calvin Harris there. That's Matthew Bourne. Montauk Variations number 4, Infinitude.
Indeed.
Infinitude? No, Infinitude. Ben, you brought this in.
Yes, Matthew Bourne is not the choreographer and dancer, I should mention. He's a jazz pianist who's been playing in a variety of different trios over the last decade or so. This is actually his first solo album, though. And I brought it in because I think it's a good... we're talking about infinite music, and I think it's good also to be reminded of the awesome power of the what is effectively quite a limited instrument, the grand piano. It works with incredibly interesting sort of portions of time, and it sounds like it's actually a very steady style of playing, but actually shifts imperceptibly around the sort of tempo. And I believe it's semi improvised. And when I first heard this 3 months ago, the album comes out next week, around the time of the X Factor. And being the sort of tacky pop fan that I am, I was like, I'd love it if Matthew Bourne started writing music for big pop singers. And I do kind of still think that. But then I thought, no, this doesn't need any lyrics over it. It's a very lyrical piece of music, but that reminds you of actually sometimes the that you don't need lyrics to convey an entire story. And for me, this is an incredibly evocative piece of music. It has an entire narrative almost around it. It almost sounds like a eulogy someone's moving through, or kind of the end of an affair being sort of read out to someone. It's a very, very mysterious kind of turning over of memories. That's at least what it gives me. But the level of specificity of feeling that I get from it is remarkable for such what is essentially a very spare piece of music.
Dan?
Yeah, I really like the gaps.
Yeah.
The gaps are fantastic. I agree with you completely. I think it's an extremely evocative, powerful piece of music that exerts its power through simplicity, ultimately. It, as you say, it doesn't need other instrumentation. It doesn't need a vocalist.
You could have done with a bit of donk on it. Huh?
That applies to anything.
Of course, yeah.
A banging donk. The gaps is an interesting idea that I was thinking about recently, actually. I remember something that Code 9 said in the sort of dubstep's early days was that when they removed the every sort of second beat and created this very sparse type of dance music that demanded, as he put it, everyone to dance to the gaps. Mm. Those gaps were...
Well, that's where funk is, isn't it? That's where funk is the space, the quiet. Mm. And that's why Nile Rodgers is so brilliant, because he gives so much... Well, it's a very lush sound, but then there is tangible space that you sort of... And those spaces are the ones you fall in and end up dancing in, I think. But.
Yeah. The momentum of this track actually made me think that at one point that it was going to sort of suddenly grow into this sort of crescendoing bit.
Yeah.
And it's a false dawn.
And that's and it ends on this wonderful imperfect cadence as well. A lesser musician, I think, would have sealed it off as a performance. And it ends on this very ambiguous, almost complete cadence, but a very ambiguous end note, which is really fascinating.
Is it indicative of the rest of what is to be found on that album?
In part, yes. So it's very surprisingly varied. Actually, this track, he sensitively gives it about 4 seconds silence after the end of this track, because then the next track on it is incredibly wild and intricate and fast and violent piano improvisation.
Does that one have a donk on it?
Just constant 4-4, yeah. But then... there's a kind of blend of the contemplative and sort of fairly composed and the wild and improvised. It's a really excellent record.
I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was absolutely a beautiful piece of music. I don't really have anything to compare it to. I'm not...
If you like people who like Rand Blake or Howard Riley, these sorts of slightly on the fringes of the mainstream jazz solo pianists, I think would find a lot to love.
I think if you liked the first Brian Eno ambient album, actually, if you like the sort
always
of stuff that Robert Wyatt did or things like that, you'd probably like it as well. I thought it was great. It's out this week, is it?
It's out next week on Monday.
Fantastic. That's Matthew Bourne, Montauk Variations number 4, Infinitude. And the album is called?
Montauk Variations, yeah.
Oh, right, fantastic. So finally, time for my track, which I should warn listeners of a nervous disposition contains some bad language. So she stays on in her mind, building smoke in the sky, cause it's her only vibe. So don't wonder why. Smoke in the air, cause she don't give a fuck, she don't give a fuck, she don't give a fuck, she don't give a fuck. Now she shakes off all of her hair. That's the internet. SheDGAF, it's called. She don't give a fuck. I brought that in. The internet is Sid the Kid from Odd Futures Project with a guy called Matt Martians, who's also in Odd Future. I brought it in. I'm very equivocal about Odd Future. I am a 40-year-old man with two kids, and I really don't have time in my life to listen to some Herbert shouting about rape. I'm really not. It's inexcusable. It's also very boring. And, you know, whatever his skill, whatever these people's skills are, I don't know. And this album has nothing to do with any of that. I think what's fascinating about it as a record is that it's a really understated record for a start. She and this other guy, Matt Martians, just seem really interesting original producers. It's a bit of a scattered album, I think. It's a lot of very short tracks, like a minute and a half long, some of which don't really go anywhere. But even though the fact they don't go anywhere, there's a lot of interesting sonic ideas in it. She doesn't overplay anything. I noticed the single, which is a track called Cocaine, which, again, you sort of think you know what you're going to expect. It's an Odd Future or anything. It's an anti-drug track. It's quite intriguing. But there's a part on that where I noticed that her voice, she used that kind of slightly aerial pinkish effect of her voice sounds like it's on a, you know, knackered old C60. But it's only one, it doesn't make a big thing out of it. It's just part of the, whatever. This is probably, I think, the best song on the album. I really like the way it shifts from a sort of neo-soulish kind of thing into juddering electronics. It's actually quite an intriguing album in terms of what it's saying, because it's, she said it's like a diary, and it's clearly about a relationship collapsing. And actually, the one thing you can say that's good about the tracks that don't really go anywhere and that are a bit, it's very difficult to grasp, is they are the tracks that are about a relationship ending, and maybe a relationship ending isn't really going anywhere and it's difficult to grasp. No, whatever. Anyway, I just thought it was a lot of really interesting original ideas. I'm quite surprised the major labels put this album out, because it isn't in part very commercial, but then maybe they just realise they've got a really intriguing and original producer on their hands, and, you know, letting her have a head, which is a great thing. The album is out on Monday, I think, although it's actually already on Spotify because it came out in the States before. Right, open to the floor. Ben?
Yeah, I absolutely love the album. I love this track. It has that, what the album as a whole has that wonderful Los Angelino feel of that sort of sunshine with mixed with weed smoke vibe, yeah, that you get off Madlib and Sara, creative partners, and Erykah Badu, and all, and that you, she really is very much part of a lineage of those people, and easily is as strong as the names I've just mentioned. I think it is a really exciting voice. Definitely.
She's got good, and also she has actually got good voice as well.
Yeah, purely vocally as well.
Vocally,
yes,
she's very understated, but interesting singer,
yeah.
I think.
But then it's offset against the like Left Brain from Odd Future does a couple of guest spots, and he has this very rough, deep voice. That's the way that she uses and sort of commissions, I guess, people around her to add in extra vocal elements is really intelligent as well.
Can I ask, as someone who hasn't heard the rest of the album, does the rest of it have that, I think it's almost like a bossa nova feel to it? Because that, I mean, Sun-Kissed, yeah. I totally see that, but I like the song a lot.
It has a lot of drums on it, kind of brushed sort of live drums. I think this is probably the most bossa nova-ish.
Yeah. It's quite loud.
Single, Cocaine, is almost like, has this electro pop kind of backing, but then, like you say, with that not Ariel Pink style, but that sort of mussed up production behind it, I think, just to give it that extra edge. Yeah, it's a really broad palette of things you're using.
Can we give a shout out to the brilliance of calling your band the Internet?
I know, that's
so good.
Just gonna pop that in Google.
Have you tried Googling the Internet? You feel like a fucking
It's like
idiot.
That band, The Men, as well. That must be equally difficult.
I was thinking that, you know, there was a band called Various Artists at one point who just tried to make it impossible for themselves to sell any records. Likewise, TBC as well. I had to check this before I came in today, but there was, as I suspected, a band called TBC.
Wow.
Impossible to see them live, really.
Yeah. it's like, Morrissey used to have that song, Get Off the Stage. I thought, that's a really great thing. Fans like that one, they start shouting out for it live. I think it's a great, great album. Really worth checking out. Just an interesting and original voice, and don't be put off by her associations with the grimmer side of what Odd Future are up to. Right. I believe that brings us to the end of things today. I'd like to thank my guest this week. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Lovely to speak to you. We're going to play out with a track recorded last week at our new Band of the Day live session at the Barfly in Camden. Worship with a headline act. And this is a track called In Our Blood, the first track they ever wrote. Thank you very much for listening. The show is produced this week by Pascal Wise. Join us again next week. Bye-bye.
Record Worship.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.